2. The Third Man. 15. As they waited for Beckert and Turlock, the members of the critical situation management team were in the same seats they'd been in the previous day, but the mood in the room was markedly different. There was no idle talk. In fact, no talk at all. Gurney's mind was seesawing between his promise to reconsider his involvement with Klein and this tectonic shift in the nature of the situation. Duane Shucker's eyes were closed, but the tiny ticks playing at his eyelids belied any sense of restfulness. Goodson Clouts's mouth was drawn into a tight line. Sheridan Klein's fingers were drumming lightly on the table. Mark Torres was focused on getting his laptop communicating with the screen on the wall above Clouts's head. Gurney was struck not so much by everyone's discomfort, but by their apparent unwillingness to say a word before Beckert delivered his own view of the situation. At precisely 2 p.m., Beckert and Turlock strode into the room and took their seats. If the murder of two men Beckert had wrongly implied were cop killers had any effect on his self-confidence, it wasn't obvious. Turlock looked about as concerned as a sledgehammer. Beckert glanced at Torres's computer. You have that ready?
Yes, sir.
Torres tapped a key, and the screen on the wall displayed the words, Willard Park Crime Scene. Just hold it there for a minute. I want to say a few words about perspective. At noon today, I was interviewed by Ram News. Just before the camera started recording, the reporter made a comment to me. This new development changes everything, doesn't it? It wasn't really a question. It was an assumption. A dangerous one and a false one. What happened last night in Willard Park, far from changing everything, simply narrows our focus. The mayor's eyes were wide open. The sheriff was leaning forward as if he'd misheard something. Beckert went on. We know from our source that three individuals may have been involved in the plot to murder Officer Steele. Two of those conspirators, Jordan and Tooker, provided an alibi covering the time of the shooting. All this means is that the third member of the conspiracy was probably the actual shooter. From a messaging perspective, the focus of our search has been narrowed, not changed. Even more important when mentioning Jordan and Tooker, avoid the word innocent. There are many ways to be guilty of murder. Pulling a trigger is only one of them. The sheriff was moistening his lips.
I do admire your way with words, Dell.
Klein looked uneasy. Do we know anything more about this third man?
Our source is working on that.
Are they willing to get on the stand if it comes to that?
One step at a time, Sheridan. Right now the priority is information, and so far the information from this source has been pure gold. If I mentioned testifying publicly, it would evaporate.
Klein didn't seem surprised by the answer.
One more point regarding the Willard Park incident, said Beckert. It's important to avoid incendiary phrases. Let's agree right now on the proper wording. These two individuals were found dead, details to be determined by autopsy. Do not refer to them as having been beaten to death.
Frown lines creased the mayor's fleshy face.
But if that's what happened, Beckert explained patiently, found dead is neutral. Beaten to death is emotionally charged in a way that could exacerbate the situation on the street. We can't prevent the media from using the term, but we should definitely not encourage it.
Some puzzlement lingered in the mayor's expression, and Beckert went on. It's the description of an event that the public actually absorbs, the images and emotions conveyed by the words, not the event itself. Words matter.
Well, you're talking about spin,
Beckert frowned. That term minimizes its importance. Spin isn't the icing on the cake, it's the cake. Messaging is everything. It's politics, Duane. And politics is no small thing. Shucker nodded with the dawning grin of a man seeing the light. Beckert turned toward Torres.
Okay, bring us up to date.
Yes, sir.
At 7 this morning, our 911 center received a call from a local citizen walking his dog, reporting the discovery of two bodies in Willard Park. The 911 center contacted White River PD and mobile patrol officers were dispatched to the location. First officer on the scene conducted a prelim interview with the caller, observed and confirmed the facts, secured the site, and reported to the duty sergeant, who notified Deputy Chief Turlock, who notified me. A
Upon arrival, I contacted our evidence unit, the ME's office, and the photographer who...
Klein interrupted.
You checked the bodies for signs of life?
Yes, sir, as part of my initial observations. As additional mobile patrol units arrived, I enlisted their support in taping the scene perimeter. When the evidence officer arrived, I assigned 3 patrol officers to assist him in a wide-area cross-grid search. I ordered the remaining patrol units to close off vehicular and pedestrian access to the vicinity.
The mayor looked worried.
Well, how big a vicinity?
About 50 acres in the no-go zone, but the evidence search is currently concentrated in 2 or 3 acres.
Well, how about the media vultures?
They're subject to the same no-go zone as the general public.
I hate them bastards.
They can be difficult, but we're keeping them at bay.
That got Gurney's attention.
They showed up at the site this morning?
Yes, sir. First thing, as we were setting up our perimeter tapes.
Your initial communication regarding the incident, it occurred by phone or radio?
By phone, sir.
Interesting. Beckert's gaze rested on Gurney for a moment before he turned back to Torres.
Let's move on to your crime scene assessment.
Yes, sir. It will be clearer if I begin with the photographs and video I just received from Paul Aziz.
The sheriff raised his head like a hound catching a scent.
Aziz? I thought Scotty McClintock did our forensic photos.
That's correct, sir, but he suffered an injury last night at the VFW. He's in the hospital.
What kind of injury?
He fell down the stairs on his way to the men's room.
Ah, I do believe the boy's done that before. Be advisable in future for him to pee in the parking lot. Meantime, who's this Aziz?
One of our dispatchers, who also happens to be a professional photographer. He filled in for Officer McClinton once before. Excellent work.
What kind of name's Aziz?
I'm not sure, sir. Possibly Jordanian or Syrian?
Well, ain't that something? Seems like our country's getting more and more of them kind of people.
Gurney was taken aback by Klautz's obnoxious tone and depressed by the thought that it was probably a key part of what got him elected. Torres, after an unpleasant glance in Klautz's direction, returned to his presentation.
Paul provided us with more than we need for the purpose of documenting the crime scene, but his video coverage of possible approach and departure paths from the location of the bodies could be useful. And it shows the visual limitations of the weather conditions.
Klein frowned.
What limitations?
The fog. Began around midnight. Didn't clear up till around 10 this morning. You can see for yourself in this opening segment of the video.
Torres tapped a computer key and pointed to the monitor on the wall. At first, all that was visible was the fog itself, a formless gray mass that seemed to be moving in slow motion past the camera. As the dark branches of nearby trees began to emerge from the murky background on both sides of the screen, it became evident that the camera operator was proceeding along a heavily wooded trail.
Gurney thought he could hear footsteps and the sound of someone breathing.
As he leaned forward to listen more carefully, he was startled by a sudden high-pitched shriek.
"Jesus," said Klein. "What the hell?"
"Blackbirds," said Torres. Paul was recording audio along with the video.
"Damn things," said the sheriff. "On that twisty little trail that touches the south corner of the lake, am I right?"
The mayor frowned.
"How'd you know that?" "I'm blind, I ain't deaf. Fact, I hear better than most. The wife takes me for walks on that trail sometimes, knowing I hate the screaming of them damn birds. I've been trying to get Clifford Mergenthaler to exterminate them in pursuit of peace and quiet. For an animal control officer, he's woefully unwilling to exert any control at all. Boy's about as useless as them damn birds that don't do nothing but scream and shit."
The mayor leaned forward.
"Glory be to God, you can hear them shit?" "Don't need to hear 'em doing what I know they doing, every living being shits. Some of 'em a hell of a lot more than others."
The antique observation had a nasty undertone. Beckert glanced at Torres.
"Let's move this along.
We're coming up to the place where the trail comes out into the clearing." The shrieks of the birds on the audio track were growing more insistent. Out of the dark constriction of the trail, The screen now displayed an open area where the fog had thinned enough for Gurney to make out a wide expanse of lakeside reeds and a shed-like building. As the camera moved forward, he was able to read a sign on the building listing hourly rates for kayak rentals. The black form of a bird swooped through the camera's field of view. As the camera moved on, the ghost-like shapes of playground equipment began to come into view. A tall slide, a pair of seesaws, the angled braces of a swing set, and finally the geometrical structure of a large jungle gym. Gurney could feel his chest tightening in anticipation of what he was about to see. No matter how many times he'd come upon it in his career, the sight of violent death always jarred him. This time was no exception. As the camera panned slowly across the front of the jungle gym, the bodies of the two victims were gradually revealed. They were tied to the structure in standing positions, side by side, secured in place by ropes around their legs, stomachs, and necks. Both men were African American. Both were stripped naked. Both bodies showed obvious signs of having been beaten. Their faces were swollen, their expressions grotesque. Between the feet of one, there appeared to be a deposit of feces.
"Christ Almighty," murmured Shucker.
Klein's lips drew back in revulsion. Turlock was gazing at the screen with icy detachment. Beckert turned to Torres, who was looking sick. "Who has custody of this material?"
"Sir?"
"This video and whatever still shots were taken of the bodies. Who has possession of the original digital files?"
"I do."
"In what form?"
"The memory chips from the cameras Paul used."
"Did he make copies?"
"I don't think so. He warned me not to lose the chips."
"If one frame of that leaks onto the Internet, we'll have a race war on our hands."
"I'm aware of the risk, sir."
"We'll come back to that," said Beckert. "Let's move on to the details."
"Right."
Torres took a deep breath and continued. "Our initial inspection of the victims revealed liver mortis. We left both bodies in situ pending the MEs." Shucker interrupted him.
"That the same as what they call rigor mortis?"
"No, sir. Rigor refers to the stiffening of the deceased's muscles, usually 2 or 3 hours after death. Liver mortis occurs sooner. It refers to the pooling of the blood in the lowest parts of the body once the heart stops beating. In this case, it was observable in their feet." He tapped a computer key several times, scrolling rapidly through a series of photos, and stopping when the screen showed a close-up of the victim's legs from the knees down. The skin tone was brown, except on the feet, where it was a dark purple. There were bruises on the shins and abrasions on the ankles. Shucker's expression suggested he'd been given more information than he'd wanted. Torres continued. "In a few minutes, we'll come back to some marks on the feet that could be very significant. But first, we'll proceed in the normal order of our victim close-ups, starting at the head and working our way down." Displaying photos of both men in a split-screen format as he spoke, he pointed out numerous contusions on their faces, torsos, and legs. His voice was tight with an apparent effort to control his distress, but the details of his commentary were vivid enough to provoke a response from the blind sheriff.
"It does sound like them boys truly got the shit beat out of them."
To say his tone was uncaring would overestimate its warmth. Torres stared at him. He tapped a key and brought up a final pair of photos on the split screen, close-up shots of the soles of the victim's feet. Klein leaned forward.
"Jesus, what on God's earth?"
Turlock gazed at the screen with no more reaction than a boulder. A frown darkened Beckert's face, a cloud passing over Mount Rushmore. The mayor looked confused and worried. Burned deeply into the sole of each victim's left foot were three capital letters, a grotesque monogram. It brought to Gurney's mind an image from an old western, red-hot letters on the end of a branding iron, smoking and hissing into the side of a steer. K.R.S. 16. The sheriff broke the fraught silence.
"Hell y'all gone quiet for?"
Torres described the photo.
"Shit,"
muttered the sheriff.
Shucker looked around the table.
K.R.S.? The hell's that? Somebody's initials?
Could be, said Beckert. Gurney was pretty sure it was something else. He knew from experience that initials left at murder scenes generally stood for an organization the killer considered himself part of, or for a title he'd given himself.
K.R.S. brings to mind K.K.K., said the sheriff. If this damn thing gets pegged as a white supremacist hate crime, we'll get overrun by the feds, which is unpleasant to contemplate. You got any thoughts on that, Dell?
I'm sure we can postpone FBI intrusion for a while. After all, this could be a personal revenge killing rather than a racial act. A tricky argument to make, I know, but it could serve our purposes.
BDA agitators will be screaming for federal intervention.
No doubt. To keep control of the process, we need to, number one, craft the right public message, and number two, demonstrate rapid progress toward an arrest. Those are both achievable objectives, so long as we adhere to procedures, manage our communications carefully, and avoid stupid mistakes. Shucker looked miserable.
I just hope to God we don't start hearing on TV that White River's got Ku Kluxers running around killing people in public parks. The tourist-dependent members of the chamber would go...
Shucker's worry was cut off by three loud raps at the conference room door. Before anyone could respond, it was thrust open, and the lanky medical examiner strode in and hefted his fat briefcase onto the chair next to Klein's.
"Hate being late, gentlemen, but there's been more autopsies in the past 3 days than in 3 normal months,"
Becker told him to proceed. Thrasher removed a sheet of paper from his briefcase, perused it for a few seconds, and put it back. He pushed his horn-rimmed glasses higher on the bridge of his nose and surveyed the group around the table. His gaze hesitated for only a moment at Gurney before he launched into a summary of his findings.
Both victims suffered death by asphyxiation, consistent with strangulation. Multiple contusions on face, torso, arms, and legs are consistent with a methodical assault, utilizing at least 2 distinct club-like instruments.
Torres asked,
"Like baseball bats?"
One of them, possibly.
There were also contusions caused by something the approximate diameter of a police nightstick.
So, Klein mused, at least 2 assailants. Thrasher nodded.
A reasonable inference.
Torres looked uncomfortable.
You say one of them used a nightstick?
Or something similar. Typical nightsticks have circular grooves at one or both ends to improve the wielder's grip. Welts across the lower back of the victims display patterns consistent with grooves. The sheriff spoke up.
Anyone can get anything these days on the Internet, so I hope we ain't assuming the presence of a nightstick implies the presence of a police officer.
Beckert nodded.
There are people who'd gladly leap to that conclusion, so we'll stick to the word club rather than nightstick in any press statements.
Thrasher continued.
Interestingly, the injuries show a remarkable similarity in the number and placement of the blows to the 2 bodies.
Klein looked puzzled.
Similarity? In my experience as an emergency room physician and as a pathologist, I have examined hundreds of victims of assaults. Such injuries tend to be of a more random nature, random in placement and in force.
Torres looked as puzzled as Klein.
What are you getting at?
These blows were not delivered in the heat of passion characteristic of assaults in general. Their similar distribution on each body, the similar force with which they were delivered, and their similar number. 21 distinct contusions on Tooker, 22 on Jordan, are consistent with a methodical approach.
Designed to achieve what?
That's what you gentlemen are paid to figure out. I merely observe and report.
Klein asked if he'd noted any other oddities.
Well, naturally, the burn marks on the feet, they're consistent with the application of a custom-made branding iron, like a hobbyist's wood-burning instrument. An unusual element in itself, even without the additional peculiarity.
What peculiarity?
The burned-in letters have perfectly sharp borders.
Meaning what?
During the application of the red-hot iron, the feet remained perfectly motionless.
Torres spoke up.
I saw ligature marks on the ankles, meaning they were tied together. Also, one of the assailants could have been holding them down. Wouldn't that account for it?
Not completely.
The application of the hot iron to a sensitive area of the foot would have produced a spasm, creating observable blurring at the border of the impression.
So that means what, that they were unconscious?
Almost certainly. Yet none of the cranial injuries appear to be sufficient to cause loss of consciousness.
So they were drugged?
Yes, to the point of zero physical sensation. Something to think about.
Beckert nodded thoughtfully.
When you think about that, the difficulties that would pose, possible motives, what comes to mind?
That question moves beyond medical facts into the area of criminal hypothesizing, your specialty, not mine. I wish you the best of luck.
He picked up his briefcase and headed for the door.
My office will forward you the initial autopsy report later this afternoon. The simple opiate screens were negative, by the way. Alcohol screens were above the legal limit for driving, but hardly consistent with anesthesia. Full tox screens will be available in another day or two.
After Thrasher's parting comment, the mayor spoke up.
What the hell was he getting at, that business about the beating they got not being normal?
The sheriff was the first to respond.
He implied it was done with a high degree of planning and purpose.
What kind of purpose?
Sounded a little like he didn't know, and a lot like he didn't want to say.
Beckert addressed the table in general.
Our ME has a habit of making dramatic entrances, stirring the pot, and dashing off. We'll stick to his professional observations, evaluate them in the light of all the other evidence, and form our own conclusions.
He turned to Torres. Let's take a look at what you discovered at the crime scene.
Torres tapped a couple of computer keys, resuming his description of the evidence photos as they appeared.
These are the ropes that were used to tie the victims to the crossbars of the jungle gym. We preserve the knots and the rope end cuts for eventual matching if we can find the source.
How come you saved the knots? Chucker asked.
They would have been handled the most, so they'd be most likely to have retained abraded skin cells.
He went on to the next photo. We found these tire tracks approaching the jungle gym structure and stopping in front of it, and we found these similar tracks on one of the trails in the adjacent woods. The forensics team... Klein interrupted.
Have you determined the type of vehicle?
We believe it was a full-size UTV, something like a Kawasaki mule. Forensics is looking to match the tread pattern and width to a specific model and year. Actually, we had a piece of luck with those tires. They dropped some compacted soil on the ground near the swing set, soil that had been trapped in the tread grooves, and it doesn't appear to be native to that part of the park.
Gurney smiled. Nice, Mark, a possible link to the primary crime scene.
The mayor looked bewildered.
What? Primary crime scene?
The location where Jordan and Tooker were drugged, stripped, beaten, and branded, explained Gurney. Because that earlier site would be where most of the violence took place, it would be the most promising site for recovering physical evidence.
He turned to Torres.
If I were you, I'd have that tread soil analyzed. There may be something distinctive about it.
The sheriff cleared his throat.
Assuming it ain't horse shit.
Torres blinked.
Sir?
Folks ride horses on them trails.
Torres continued.
We found several items in the immediate area that may be related to the incident. Human hairs, a lottery ticket, two cigarette butts, a flashlight battery, and an item of special interest, a used condom. It was discovered in a grassy area about 100 feet from the bodies, partly sheltered by a row of bushes. It didn't look like it had been there very long.
And you're thinking whoever left it there might be a witness? Asked Klein.
It's a possibility, sir. We rushed it to Albany. We might get a hit on CODIS and get an ID. It's a long shot, but...
Beckert nodded.
Anything more to show us?
Some satellite views of the area to identify possible site entry and exit routes. Judging from the leaves partly off the trees, the photos were probably taken last autumn.
Centered on the jungle gym, the first photo encompassed the immediate area of the crime scene. The kayak rental building, the reedy shore of the lake, some of the surrounding trees. Torres pointed out the locations of the tire tracks. The next two photos showed more of the park and more of the wooded areas. The final shot showed the entire park, bordered on three sides by city streets, and on the fourth by an extensive wilderness area into which some of the park's trails extended. A couple of miles into that wilderness area, another lake was visible. Along its shore were a number of small clearings. Torres explained that the White River Gun Club owned the lake and the land around it, and in the clearings there were cabins owned by club members.
Mostly White River cops, as far as I know, he added.
He glanced at Beckert and Turlock as if for confirmation, but neither man responded.
"The dog walker who discovered the bodies," said Klein, "where did he come from?"
Torres got up, went over to the screen, and traced the route as he was describing it. "He came into the park through the entrance on the east side, crossed the main field, past the statue of Colonel Willard, and headed down toward the lake. Because of the fog this morning, he got within about 50 feet of the bodies before he realized what he was looking at. Was still a nervous wreck when we arrived."
Beckert pointed at the screen.
"That large field he crossed, the one taking up the northeast quadrant of the park, that's where the BDA demonstration was held and where our officer was shot. I don't think it's just a coincidence that Jordan and Tooker were executed in that same park. Clearly a symbolic action, which reinforces the importance of our maintaining control of the narrative. It's vital that any new piece of evidence, information, rumor, anything at all with any bearing on any of the three killings be reported at once to Judd or to me directly."
Evidently satisfied that silence meant agreement, Beckert moved on.
"Given the pressures of dealing with two explosive crimes and the need to make rapid progress on both fronts at once, I'm dividing the investigative duties. Detective Torres, your primary responsibility will be the steel sniper shooting. With our first two suspects out of the picture, your focus will be identifying and locating the third man, the actual shooter."
Gurney was struck by the insinuation in Beckert's choice of words. How the third man being the actual shooter subtly maintained, in some non-trigger-pulling capacity, the involvement of Jordan and Tooker. Beckert went on.
"Because of its complex public relations dimensions, I'll assume personal responsibility for the investigation into these playground homicides. The case file, incident report, site sketches and photos should be turned over to me as soon as we're finished here, including the memory chips from Paul Aziz's cameras, understood?"
Torres looked puzzled by the shift in responsibility.
"Yes, sir."
"And that's all for now, except for one thing?" He looked at Gurney. "The phone. Is Steele's wife going to hand it over voluntarily or not?"
"We'll see. I left a message for her."
"She has until tomorrow morning. Either she hands it over by then or we visit her with a warrant and take it. Questions, anyone? No? Good. We'll meet here tomorrow, the same time."
He placed his hands on the table, pushed back his chair, and stood up decisively, the very image of determination. Behind him, the picture window displayed its panorama of stone buildings with spirals of razor wire gleaming in the afternoon sun. 17. When Gurney came out into the police headquarters parking lot and headed for his Outback, he saw Klein standing next to it, taking a deep drag on a cigarette. He exhaled slowly, the hand holding the cigarette moving in a wide arc down to his side. Deja vu, a disturbing decades-old image of Gurney's mother. Her bursts of nervous chain-smoking, the desperate pursuit of peace revealing a terrible anxiety. When Klein saw Gurney approaching, he took a final drag, threw the butt to the ground, and stepped on it as if it were a wasp that had just stung him. There was a briefcase at his feet. He reached down and pulled a large manila envelope out of it.
"Everything you asked for yesterday, full copy of the steel case file, incident and interview reports, crime scene photos and sketches, ballistics report, plus Jordan's and Tooker's past arrests and your temporary credentials. Special Senior Investigator, Office of the District Attorney." He handed the envelope to Gurney.
"Anything on the so-called third man?"
"If there's anything on that, Beckert's keeping it to himself."
"Like the identities of his informants."
"Right."
He took out another cigarette, hurriedly lit it, and took a particularly long drag before continuing.
"So, what are your observations so far?"
"You look like an extremely worried man."
Klein said nothing. That in itself said something. Gurney decided to push further.
"The obvious interpretation of the message on Steele's phone is that someone in the department might take advantage of the chaos in the streets to get rid of him. If that someone turned out to be Turlock or even Beckert..."
"Jesus." Klein raised his hand. "You have any evidence for what you're saying?"
"None, but I don't have any evidence that points to a third man from the BDA either."
"What about these two new homicides? You have any thoughts?"
"Only that they may not be what they seem to be."
"What makes you think that?"
"Thrasher's comments about the damage to the bodies."
Klein was looking increasingly miserable.
If they aren't what they seem to be, what the hell are they?
I need time to think about that.
While you're thinking about Steele?
I guess.
So which case is your priority?
The Steele shooting.
Why?
Because it came first, and something in it may explain the odd aspects of the other. Klein frowned, evidently trying to digest this. Then he pointed to the manila envelope in Gurney's hand.
Let me know if anything in the case file pops out at you. You have my personal cell number. Call me any time, day or night.
Away from the depressing environs of White River, the countryside had a bucolic timelessness, displaying the glories of early May. Black Angus cows dotted the hillsides, apple trees were in blossom. The black earth of freshly tilled cornfields alternated with fields of emerald grass and buttercups. Only dimly aware of the beauty around him, Gurney spent the drive home pondering the strange facts of both cases. Despite his decision to focus on the sniper attack, he found it difficult to keep Thrasher's comments about the beatings and brandings from intruding into his thoughts. As he arrived at the narrow road that led to his hilltop property, his attention switched to a more pressing issue. Having told Madeline that he'd sleep on the question of whether to continue his involvement with Klein, he felt the need to make a decision. On the one hand, there was the growing challenge of the situation itself, and the accelerating pressure to avert an escalation of violence. Daunting as that sounded, it was the kind of challenge he was built for. On the other hand, there was his discomfort with the district attorney himself. He felt as if he were locked in a loop of indecision. Each time he was about to conclude that the importance of the case might outweigh the risk of trusting Klein, the memory of Madeline's question intervened. My God, David, on what planet would that be considered a good idea? As he was parking by the side door of the old farmhouse, still wrestling with his dilemma, his phone rang.
Gurney here. Thanks for picking up. It's Mark Torres. Do you have a minute?
What can I do for you?
I'm calling about the photos Paul Aziz took at Willard Park. I was wondering if you might want to see them.
The photos you showed at the meeting today?
I just showed the ones I thought were most important. Paul took over 200 shots. Before I turned the camera chips over to Chief Beckert, I downloaded everything to my laptop.
And you want me to have all that?
As you know, I've been taken off the Jordan Tooker case to concentrate on the Steele shooting, but I figured you'd still have an interest in both cases and the photos might be helpful to you.
You don't think Beckert will share them with me?
Torres hesitated.
I couldn't say.
Gurney wondered if Torres was suffering from the same distrust of the WRPD brass that seemed to have infected Klein. In any event, it wouldn't hurt to take a look at Aziz's photos.
How do you want to get them to me?
Through a file-sharing service. As soon as I get it set up, I'll email you.
Viewing this minor involvement with the photos as a separate matter from any decision about his overall commitment, Gurney thanked Torres and said he'd watch for the email. He ended the call, got out of the car, and went into the house. According to the old regulator clock on the kitchen wall, it was a minute past five. He called Madeline's name. There was no response. He knew it wasn't one of her work days at the clinic, and if she'd been called in, she'd have left a note for him on the door. He went back outside and checked the areas where she enjoyed busying herself, the garden beds, the asparagus patch, and the prefab greenhouse they'd erected earlier that spring to get a head start on the short upstate growing season. He called her name again. He went around to the rear of the house, looking across the high pasture to the edge of the encircling forest. The only living creatures he saw were the distant vultures riding the updrafts over the ridge. He decided to go back inside and call her cell phone. But just then he caught sight of her making her way up through the low pasture from the direction of the pond. He noted something different about the way she was walking, something less spirited than usual in her step. When she came closer, he could see that her expression was almost grim, and when she was closer still, he could see in her eyes the signs of recent tears. "What is it?" he asked. She looked around uncertainly until her eyes came to rest on the pair of Adirondack chairs facing each other in the middle of the stone patio. "Can we sit out here for a while?"
Sure.
Something wrong? When they were both seated, their knees almost touching, she closed her eyes for a long moment, as though trying to arrange her thoughts.
Maddie, did something happen?
Kim Steele was here.
What does she want?
She brought her husband's cell phone.
She left it with you?
Yes.
He waited for her to go on, but she didn't.
Her visit was upsetting.
Yes.
Because of what happened to her husband?
Because of the kind of person he was.
She swallowed.
He was like you.
And you're thinking what happened to him could have happened to me?
Yes.
After a few moments, she continued.
The way she described him was exactly how I would describe you, believing that being a cop was a good way of life, a way of being useful, believing that doing what's right was the most important thing.
They sat there for a long while in silence.
There's something else, she said, wiping away a tear. They lost a child.
He felt a chill rising into his chest.
An infant, a car accident.
Jesus.
They're us, David, 20 years ago. The only difference is that you're alive and her husband isn't.
Looking into her eyes, he could see that the power of her identification with another woman's pain had upended yesterday's reality.
I didn't want you getting into this thing, getting tangled up with Sheridan Klein, but now I can't help thinking that if this had happened to you,
you would have wanted someone to do something about it.
Yes. Someone good and honest and determined enough to get to the bottom of it.
She paused, then added emphatically,
Yes. I would have wanted that.
18. The shift in Madeline's view had a profound effect on Gurney. Her change of heart felt to him like a kind of liberation. What was clear to her was now clear to him. His job was simply to solve the murder of Kim Steele's husband. The rest, Klein's shadowy motives for pulling him in, the putative political connections and ambitions of Del Beckert, White River's potential race war, were important but secondary issues. They would become relevant only if they helped explain the death of John Steele. After dinner, Gurney retreated to the den with the case file Klein had given him in the parking lot and the cell phone Kim had left with Madeline. The first thing he did, after checking for the phone's call records and text chains and discovering they'd all been deleted except for the final warning, was to call the district attorney's personal number. Klein picked up immediately, his voice anxious.
Yes?
I have Steele's cell phone.
His wife gave it to you?
Yes.
Did you find anything in it, anything relevant?
Nothing but the last message.
How quickly can you get the phone to me?
Gurney was struck by the wording of Klein's question, the me in particular. He wondered if the intention was as exclusive as it sounded.
I could bring it to tomorrow's team meeting. Beckert seemed eager for it.
When Klein responded with silence, he went on.
Or, since time is a critical factor, you might want to send one of your people to my house for it, and they could drive it directly to computer forensics in Albany, and in the meantime you could get a warrant for the service provider's call records.
So you're suggesting that in the interest of saving time, we bypass White River PD and go directly to the state lab?
Gurney almost laughed out loud. Instinctive ass-coverer that he was, Klein was making it clear that this route, which he obviously preferred, was Gurney's suggestion.
It would be a reasonable way to proceed, said Gurney.
You're probably right, considering the importance of the time factor. Okay, I'll have a car at your house tomorrow morning at 7 sharp.
The conversation confirmed for Gurney that the man was uneasy enough with Beckert or someone else in the department to keep the phone out of their hands until there was an objective record of whatever information could be extracted from it. He turned his attention to the manila envelope, pulled out the case file, and spread out its contents on the den desk. He saw the standard items, the incident report, witness statements, site photos and sketches, early progress reports, various updates, and addenda, none of which at first glance were especially helpful or surprising. There was also a DVD. It was labeled Ramcam Video Willard Park Steele Homicide.
He pushed aside the other items and inserted it in his laptop's external drive. The video was as he remembered it from the big screen TV at the Gelters' party, and again at the first CSMT meeting. Presumably excerpted from a longer recording, the segment began about 3 minutes prior to the shot and continued for about 2 minutes after it. During this viewing, Gurney timed the appearance of the red laser dot on the back of Steele's head, confirming his initial estimate that it preceded the fatal shot by just over 2 minutes. The precision with which the dot followed Steele's movements confirmed his impression that the rifle that fired the shot was mounted on a tripod, possibly one with a motion-dampening mechanism of the kind used in filmmaking. He watched the video 3 times. On the 3rd viewing, he noted an oddity that hadn't struck him before. When Steele was shot, he was moving to a new position on the sidewalk. But for nearly 20 seconds leading up to that, he'd been standing still. Why had the shooter bypassed that easy opportunity in favor of a riskier moving target? He continued going through the file until he came to a computer printout labeled Potential Shooter Sites Defined by Bullet Trajectory Parameters. The printout displayed a narrow triangular outline overlaid on a map of White River. The tip of the triangle touched the spot at the edge of the park where Steele was shot. The outline extended out from that point approximately 1/4 mile across the center of the city, enclosing the likely area from which the shot had come based on the calculated trajectory. Although there was no indication in the file what was being done with this diagram, it was obvious to Gurney that the next step would be to narrow the possibilities by going to the spot where Steele was standing at the moment of impact, and with binoculars survey the area contained within the triangle to find the clear lines of sight to windows, rooftops, and open areas not obscured by other structures. Since the target had to be visible to the sniper's location would have to be visible from the target's location. Taking this simple step would dramatically limit the areas that needed to be searched. He was tempted to call Mark Torres and make sure this was happening, but something told him not to interfere. The sniper's location would soon be identified and turned over to the crime scene team with their cameras, vacuums, evidence bags, and fingerprint kits. In the interim, there was plenty for him to do that didn't involve stepping on other people's toes. Another face-to-face conversation with Kim Steele, for example, might be a more productive use of his time. During her visit earlier that day, Kim had given Madeline her address, email, and phone number. He picked up his phone and entered Kim's number. Yes, her voice was leaden. Kim, this is Dave Gurney. Yes? I have a meeting in White River tomorrow. I was wondering if I could stop by on my way and talk to you. Tomorrow? It would be sometime in the morning, is that all right? It's all right. I'm here. He wondered whether her monotone responses were coming from the exhaustion of grief or an emotion-deadening medication. Thank you, Kim. I'll see you tomorrow morning. That night, for the first time in more than a year, he had the dream. A dreadful, disjointed replaying of the accident long ago that killed his 4-year-old son. On their way to the playground on a sunny day, Danny walking in front of him, following a pigeon on the sidewalk, he himself only partly present, pondering a twist in a murder case he was working on. Distracted by a bright idea, a possible solution. The pigeon stepping off the curb into the street. Danny following the pigeon. The sickening, heart-stopping thump. Danny's body tossed through the air, hitting the pavement, rolling, rolling. The red BMW racing away, screeching around a corner. Gone. Gurney awoke in an agony of grief, in the gray light of dawn. Madeline holding his hand, she knew about the dream. He'd been having it on and off for nearly 20 years. When the lingering images had subsided and the worst of the feeling had passed, he got up, took a shower, and dressed. At 7 a.m., Klein's man arrived as promised, accepted Steele's cell phone, and departed with hardly a word. At 7:45 a.m., Geraldine Merkel arrived to pick up Madeline for one of their same scheduled days at the clinic. At 8:30 a.m., Gurney left for his meeting with Kim Steele. His GPS directed him off the interstate at the Larvotton Badminton exit onto Fisher's Road, heading north toward Angina. A few miles later, it directed him onto Drybrook Lane, a gravelly road that rose in a series of S-curves through an old hardwood forest. At a driveway marked by a brightly painted mailbox, his GPS announced he had reached his destination. The driveway brought him into a clearing, at the center of which stood a small farmhouse surrounded by flower beds and lush spring grass. A red barn with a metal roof stood at the edge of the clearing. Kim Steele's small white car was parked by the house, and he parked next to it. He knocked on the side door and waited. He knocked again. After a third attempt, he went around to the back door with the same result. While he was puzzling over the situation, he looked out over the back field toward the barn and noticed a riding mower next to the barn door. As he headed across the field, Kim Steele emerged from the barn toting a large red gas can. She carried it to the mower and was in the process of opening the gas tank when she saw him. She watched him approaching, then returned to her task, hefting the can into position and wrestling its stiff spout into the tank opening. She spoke without looking up. "Things have to get done. Can I help?" She seemed not to hear him. Appearing marginally more organized than the last time he'd seen her, she was wearing the same shirt, but the buttons were now aligned. Her hair seemed neater, shinier. "They called him in on his day off," she said, trying to balance the big can over the tank. "He wanted to mow this field. He said it was important to mow it at least once a week, or the grass would clog the mower. Once it gets clogged..." "Let me help you with that." He reached for the can. "No, this is my job." "Okay." He paused. "You were saying they called him in?" She nodded. "Because of the demonstration?" "They were calling everyone in." "Did he say who in the department called him?" She shook her head. "Do you remember if there were any other calls for him that day?"
"The day he was killed?"
It wasn't a question so much as a burst of anger. He paused again. "I know it's horrible to think about this." She cut him off.
"It's all I think about. There's nothing else I can think about, so ask whatever you want."
He nodded. "I'm just wondering if John got any other calls that day other than the message you found on his phone."
"Shit!"
The mower's gas tank was overflowing. She yanked the can away and dropped it on the ground. She appeared close to tears. The situation touched him in a way that made it difficult for him to speak. The strong odor of the fuel filled the still air. "That overflowing gas thing happens to me all the time," he said awkwardly. She said nothing. "Can I mow the field for you?"
"What?"
"I spend a lot of time mowing at home. I enjoy it. It would be one less thing for you to have to do. I'd be happy to do it." She looked at him, blinking as if to clear her vision.
"That's kind of you, but I have to do these things myself."
A silence fell between them. He asked, "Have John's friends from the department been coming by to see you?"
"Some people came. I told them to go away."
"You didn't want them here?"
"I can't bear to even look at them until I know what happened."
"You don't trust anyone in the department?"
"No, only Rick Loomis."
"He's different from the others."
"Rick and John were friends, allies."
"Allies suggests they had enemies."
"Yes, they had enemies."
"Do you know the names of their enemies?"
"I wish to God I did, but John didn't believe in bringing the ugly details of his work home. I'm sure he thought he was making my life easier by keeping things to himself."
"Do you know if Rick Loomis shared your husband's suspicions about things that were going on in the department?"
"I think so."
"Was he helping him look into old cases?"
"They were working on something together. I know I sound hopelessly vague."
She sighed, picked up the gas tank cap, and screwed it back on. "If you'd like to come in for a while, I could make some coffee."
"I'd like that.
And I'd like to hear more about your husband, anything you want to tell me. I'd like to understand who he was." As soon as he said it, he could see in her eyes the impact of that past tense verb, was. He wished he'd found another way of saying it. She nodded, wiped her hands on her jeans, and led the way across the field to the house. The back door opened into a narrow hallway that led to an eat-in kitchen. There was a broken dish on the floor by the sink. The khaki jacket she'd worn on her first trip to Gurney's house was lying across the seat of a chair. The table was covered with a disordered pile of papers.
She looked around in dismay. I didn't realize what a mess. Let me just... Her voice trailed off. She gathered the papers together and took them into the next room. She returned, got the jacket, and took that away. She seemed not to notice the broken dish. She gestured toward one of the chairs at the table, and Gurney sat down. Distractedly, she went through the steps of setting up the coffee machine. While the coffee was brewing, she stood gazing out the window. When it was ready, she poured a mug and brought it to the table. She sat down across from him and smiled in a way that he found almost unbearably sad. "What do you want to know about John?" she asked. "What was important to him? His ambitions, how he ended up in the WRPD. When he started getting uncomfortable with it, any hints of trouble prior to the text message that could relate to what happened?" She gave him a long, thoughtful look. "Interesting questions. In what way?" "They have nothing to do with the WRPD theory that the attack was a political act by black radicals." He smiled at her perceptiveness. "The WRPD theory is being pursued by WRPD people. There's no point my heading down the same avenue." "You mean the same dead end?" "Too soon to say." He sipped his coffee. "Tell me about John." "He was the nicest, smartest man in the world. We met in college, Ithaca. John was a psych major, very serious, very handsome. We got married right after graduation. He'd already taken the state police exam, and a few months later he was inducted. I was pregnant by then. Everything seemed to be going well. He graduated from the academy at the top of his class. Life was perfect. Then a month after our baby was born, there was an automobile accident. She didn't survive." Kim fell silent, biting her lower lip and looking away toward the window. A few moments later, she took a deep breath, sat up straight in her chair, and continued. "He spent the next 3 years as a state trooper. He got a master's degree in criminology in his spare time. It was around that time that Del Beckert was hired to clean up the White River Police Department. He made a big impression, forcing a lot of people out on corruption charges, bringing in fresh faces." She paused. When she went on, something rueful, maybe even bitter, entered her voice. "The image Beckert projected, sweeping out the dirt, purifying the place. I think that struck a chord with John, so he moved from the NYSP to the supposedly wonderful new WRPD. "When did he realize it might not be as perfect as he'd imagined?" "It was a gradual thing. His attitude toward the job changed. I remember it getting darker a year ago with the Laxton Jones shooting. After that, there was a kind of tension in him that wasn't there before." "How about recently?" "It was getting worse." Gurney took another sip of his coffee. "You said he'd gotten degrees in psychology and criminology." She nodded, almost smiled. "Yes. He loved his work and loved learning anything connected with it. In fact, he just started taking some law courses." Gurney hesitated. "He was a basic patrol officer, right?" There was a combative flash in her eyes. "You mean just a basic patrol officer? You're asking why he wasn't chasing promotions?" He shrugged. "Most cops I've known who've pursued advanced degrees..." She cut him off. "Pursued them because of career ambitions? The truth is, John has... had enormous ambition, but not for promotions. He wanted to be out on the street. That's what he signed up for. The degrees, all the reading he did, it was to be as good at the job as he could be. His ambition was to lead an honest, useful, positive life. That's all he ever..." She lowered her head slowly and began to sob. Several minutes later, after that wave of grief had run its course, she sat back in her chair and wiped her eyes. "Do you have any more questions?" "Do you know if he ever received threats or hints of trouble other than the text message?" She shook her head. "If something should come to mind, I'll call you, I promise." "Okay. One last thing. Do you think Rick Loomis would talk to me?" "I'm sure he'll talk to you. But if you're asking how open he'll be about what he and John were working on, that I don't know." "Would you be willing to call him, tell him who I am and that I'd appreciate sitting down with him?" She cocked her head curiously. You want me to tell him that he should trust you?
Just tell him whatever you're comfortable telling him is entirely up to you.
Her eyes met his, and for a moment he had the same feeling he had on the occasions when Madeline's gaze seemed to be looking into his soul.
Yes, she said. I can do that.
19. Toward the end of Gurney's visit with Kim Steele, the vibrating mode on his phone had made him aware of receiving a call, but he'd let it go rather than interrupt the emotional flow of their conversation. Now, on his way back to the interstate, he pulled over onto the grassy verge of Fisher's Road and listened to the message. It was from Sheridan Klein. The man didn't bother to identify himself. His self-important, slightly nasal voice was identification enough. I hope you get this message soon. We have a schedule change. Our meeting has just been moved up to 12 noon. Major progress. Noon sharp. Be there. Gurney checked the current time. 11:04. He figured that without traffic he could be in White River by 11:30. Despite his earlier decision to avoid conflict with the WRPD by avoiding the crime scene, he was tempted now to do at least a drive-by to get a visceral sense of the location he'd seen only on video. As expected, there was no traffic. It was just 11:29 when he turned off the interstate. The White River exit ramp led to a local road that descended from a green landscape of woods and meadows into an area of man-made desolation. He drove past the big rusting conveyors of the defunct Handsome Brothers Stone Quarry and into the city itself, where the stench of smoke and ashes began to infiltrate the car. Recalling from the White River map how the main streets were laid out, he made his way onto the avenue that skirted the boarded-up buildings of the Grinton section and led directly to Willard Park. He turned onto the road adjacent to the park and soon came to a barricade consisting of yellow sawhorses, each of which bore the warning, "Police line, do not cross." Leaving his car there and stepping between the sawhorses, he went ahead on foot to a circular area that was more aggressively cordoned off with a double perimeter of yellow police tape. The protected area encompassed the edge of the field where the demonstration had been held, an enormous pine whose lowest branches were a good 20 feet above the ground and part of the sidewalk. On the sidewalk was a large, irregularly shaped reddish-brown stain. Gurney was sure that the crime scene specialists would have been long finished with their evidence gathering, and that his presence posed no danger of contamination. When he entered the taped-off area, however, he did step gingerly around that stain as a gesture of respect. Looking closely at the tree, he could see the remnants of the channel cut by the bullet as it embedded itself in the relatively soft pine trunk. Some of the channel had been chiseled open to extract the bullet. He took a pen from his shirt pocket and placed it in the channel against the side that appeared intact. The pen, aligned with the path of the bullet, then became a rough pointer to the source of the shot. He could see immediately that it corroborated the trajectory projection on the map in the case file. Gazing out in the indicated direction, he could see that the likely sources were limited to the upper floors of 3 or 4 apartment buildings. He headed back to the barricade where he'd parked, in the hope of finding the binoculars he sometimes kept in the glove compartment. That goal was put aside, however, when he saw a WRPD cruiser pull up at the same barricade. The cop who emerged from the cruiser had an end-of-shift weariness about him. After looking over the outback, presumably for any signs of official status, he turned his attention to Gurney.
"How are we doing today, sir?"
If the question was meant to sound friendly, it failed.
"I'm doing okay. How about you?"
The cop's eyes hardened as if Gurney's reply were a challenge.
"Are you aware that you're in a restricted area?"
"I'm on the job, investigation department, DA's office."
"That's so."
Gurney said nothing.
"Never saw you before. You want to show me some ID?"
Gurney took out his wallet and handed him the credentials he'd gotten from Klein. He regarded them with a skeptical frown.
"DA's office? You know Jimmy Crandall? Only person I know there is Sheridan Klein."
The cop sucked thoughtfully at his teeth.
"Well, the thing is, this is a restricted area, so I need to ask you to leave."
The restriction applies to the DA's investigators?"
"Piaca applies to everyone."
"What's Piaca?"
Primary Investigative Agency Controls Access.
Nice acronym. Local invention?